You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, we discussed yesterday the two appeals court, circuit court decisions, one in the D.C. Circuit that said that the Affordable Care Act says that the people will be eligible for subsidies via the IRS as a consequence of getting health insurance purchased on exchanges established by the state, by a state, is the exact language, and how this the Fourth Circuit said, well, you know, we're going to use the logic of the Chevron case, which said the first question you have to ask is, what was the intent of Congress? And if there's a badly written law or a typographic error in a law, that becomes irrelevant. The question is, what was the intent of Congress? And this has become referred to as the Chevron standard or the Chevron doctrine, and that's basically what the Fourth Circuit used. So David Hogberg is with us. He's a senior fellow and healthcare policy analyst with the National Center for Public Policy Research. Nationalcenter.org is their website. His Twitter is at David Hogberg, H-O-G-B-E-R-G, or at National Center. Hey, David, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This case is Halbig v. Burwell in the D.C. Circuit. And, the Affordable Care Act, the subtitle of the section which contains this language that, the subsidies will be provided to people who sign up through an exchange created by a state. The title of this section is Affordable Coverage Choices for All Americans. How could that not have been the intent of Congress?
Well, it's not clear what the intent of Congress was, as both the D.C. Circuit Court and the Fourth Circuit Court found. They could not come to any conclusive decision on what the intent of Congress was.
Then why did Congress write into the bill, the Affordable Care Act will achieve near universal coverage? That's a verbatim quote from the bill itself, from the legislation itself.
So is the fact that tax credits only apply to state exchanges, and there is no clear evidence on what Congress intended on that as well. And courts have to deal with actual evidence, not evidence that might have existed if someone had asked Congress about that issue. So both the Fourth Circuit, which did end up saying that still ended up saying that premium subsidies do apply to federal exchanges, still said, and this is a quote, "We cannot discern whether Congress intended one way or another to make the tax credits available on HHS-facilitated exchanges." And what the Chevron deference basically means isn't necessarily that you look at congressional intent. You start with whether or not the particular part of the statute is vague, and then you look at the agency's interpretation of it, in this case the IRS, and is that interpretation reasonable based on the statute? And if the court concludes that it's reasonable, then you defer to the agency.
Let me quote from Chevron. This was the opinion, the majority opinion, that was written by John Paul Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
And here, this is what it says. This is the doctrine that the Supreme Court uses. First, always, is the question whether Congress has directly spoken to the precise question at issue. If the intent of Congress is clear, that is the end of the matter, semicolon. For the court, as well as the agency, in this case the IRS, must give effect to the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress. The Affordable Care Act is this section is called Affordable Coverage Choices for All Americans. The word all is in there. It's unambiguous. The Affordable Care Act says, as its purpose, that it will achieve near universal coverage for all Americans. I'm quoting from the Act. So are you really trying to suggest that when the Affordable Care Act was put together, this, 1,000-plus pieces of legislation, that it wasn't a typo, that it says from a state that they put this in there knowing that it would blow the act up and knock 5 million people off their insurance a few years down the road?
No. In fact, I suspect that if you were to ask every single Democrat who voted for it whether or not they wanted...
And the Republicans who voted for it.
it was mostly Democrats.
But there were Republicans.
Okay, let's not get hung up on little tiny details, all right? I'm sure they would say, yes, the subsidies were supposed to go to both federal and state exchanges. The problem is, as the courts in both the Fourth and the D.C. District Court pointed out, there is no compelling evidence of what their intent was. You know, courts have to deal with actual evidence, not on what we think the evidence might be, and there just is no evidence of their intent.
Okay, so let's assume, David Hochberg, that your assertion that when Congress passed a law called the Affordable Care Act that said that the goal of the act was to provide health care to all Americans, near universal coverage, that that's not really what Congress meant, and we can't figure out what they actually meant. Let's assume that for a moment. That sentence that says, you know, eligible for subsidies for people who are buying the insurance through an exchange created by a state could be fixed by adding two words, state or federal, right? It could be fixed by adding two words. This is something that the House of Representatives and the Senate could do this afternoon in 15 minutes. Why are Republicans refusing to fix a small error in the Affordable Care Act? Why do Republicans want to knock roughly 5.5 million people off their health insurance, or at least raise the price? I mean, the guy who was suing, Mr. Halbig, he was suing over having to pay $21 a year for his health insurance because he earns $20,000 a year in West Virginia.
What is the question here? You're kind of
why are Republicans not saying, okay, we found a problem with Obamacare and we want to make this work better for people, and so we're going to add these two words to the law, and we're going to pass it out of the House of Representatives, and we're going to send it over to the Senate. This is going to be completely bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats both, much like Medicare Part D was under George W. Bush.
Well, I can't speak specifically to Republicans' motivations, but I tell you why I wouldn't do it, and that is that it basically amounts to putting a couple of Band-Aids on the gash in the Titanic. I mean, the exchanges are are poor insurance, where people have faced higher premiums than they were previously paying, higher out-of-pocket costs.
70% of Republicans are happy with
higher, you know, they don't have their doctors in their networks. And eventually this is going to lead to a death spiral where premiums are very, very high. And I suspect that, you know, anyone who makes over 400% of the federal poverty threshold will simply drop out because the premiums are going to be too high and you're going to create this new class.
David, nobody's buying that stuff anymore. I mean, all that scaremongering is what got rolled out during the 2012 election. Nobody's buying it anymore. 70% of Republicans are happy with the Obamacare they have. Healthcare costs are rising at the lowest rate they've risen since the 50s. You know, things are under control. Millions of people are insured, and they're very happy with it.
They're not happy with it. There's plenty of no.
Look at the Pew poll that was just done. 70% of Republicans.
No, where is that coming from? Where is that particular piece?
I believe it was Pew. It was one of these, you know, it was one of these reputable, non-affiliated polling groups.
Well, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that there were a lot of people with their new insurance who were, especially the people who had to switch, who were unhappy with it. And no, I mean, the slowdown in healthcare costs started long before Obamacare, and we're beginning to see from GDP numbers that it's beginning to pick up. I mean, the New York Times admitted the other day.
So, what's your solution?
The other day,
David,
that if you're going to increase coverage this much, you know, costs are going to rise.
What's your solution?
A free market solution.
In other words, say to everybody, you're on your own. If you're rich, great.
No,
if you're poor, you're screwed.
That's just a leftist distortion of what the free market actually is. Sorry. But nice try, though.
All right. Well, you know, I got to try. David Hochberg, Senior Fellow and Healthcare Policy Analyst at the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it looks like we've... the Obamacare wars are still going on. It's like Republicans are... You got 9 million people who now have health insurance. And absolutely, I guarantee you, there are some people for whom it wasn't the best thing. There are some people who are looking at this going, you know, this was not the greatest deal for me. My insurance rates went up, or my deductibles went up, or my copays went up, or, you know, the coverage that I got is not as good as what I used to have. There's absolutely going to be some people like that. But the vast majority of people who are getting Obamacare, and pretty much all of us who are affected by it, are very happy with the fact that if we get seriously sick, our health insurance companies can't dump us anymore. What they used to call rescission, that's been made illegal. The vast majority of us are very happy with, you know, the fact that health insurance companies, which used to take 30, 35, 40, 45%, they'd skim it off the top and pay it to their CEOs. Stephen Helmsley, the CEO of United Healthcare, has taken over $1 billion in compensation. You can't take $1 billion out of one. And the guy before him, Dollar Bill McGuire, took $1.87 billion in his 10 years running United Healthcare. You can't take $1 billion as the CEO of a company if you're not running some kind of friggin' money machine. Some kind of incredible scam, and it was a scam. And the Affordable Care Act says, okay, you can rip people off, but no more than 20%. And if you're a small insurance company, 25%. And that seems to me like, you know, frankly, I think they should not be ripping us off at all. I think we should be saying for primary care, you can't be a for-profit corporation, and you can't compensate your CEOs millions of dollars or billions of dollars. But, hey, this isn't the world that I would run. I mean, you know, I'm not the king or the president or even, you know, a member of Congress. I'm just an author and a talk show host. So, you know, my opinion and $2 will buy you a cup of coffee. Well, maybe $5 these days will buy you a cup of coffee. But it's quite apparent to me that the caucus room conspiracy, the destroy any kind of legacy Obama has, prevent him from having any successes. And if he has any successes, because we had 74 legislative days there between the time Al Franken was sworn in and the time Scott Brown was sworn into the Senate, there were 74 legislative days there where Democrats actually could get things passed. And they went through quite a – I've got a little list here. I mean, it was pretty amazing. The largest middle-class tax cut in the history of the United States. They saved Chrysler. They saved GM. They turned 800,000 job losses a month into job gains. They increased spending on education. They decreased the cost of student loans. They strengthened hate crime acts. They passed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. They expanded the children's the CHIPS program, this children health insurance program, whatever it is. It's child care. They expanded enforcement of the child labor laws. They reformed Wall Street to some extent. Reformed credit card laws to some extent. They stopped predatory lending for soldiers. They started paying troops for stop loss time. They stopped engaging in torture. They increased VA spending. The Equal Pay for Women Act. Nuclear arms reduction and disposal. I mean, all this stuff happened in those 74 days. And then Scott Brown was sworn in, and the caucus room conspiracy went back into overdrive. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. George in Eureka, California. Hey, George, what's up?
Thank you again for being who you are. Please get on ABC, NBC, CBS as well as where you are right now.
They don't want me.
My nephew at the age of...
You can't... Let me just say, George, and I think that the woman who was on CNN day before yesterday, who said our coverage of the Palestinian side of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is horrible, and now she's been kicked off the air. That's why I am not applying for jobs at those networks, and why they wouldn't have me if I did.
I don't want you to apply for.
I'm fine
there.
Right
I
here.
I want you to be interviewed.
Yeah, well, they're not even willing to do that. And since I wrote the book talking about how Roger Ailes was, you know, he came up with GOP TV when he was in the Nixon administration and finally sold it to Rupert Murdoch. Fox has stopped inviting me. I'm fine right here. I'm happy doing this show. But anyhow, back to you, George.
Well, thank you. As I said, my nephew at the age of 51 can get married.
Finally? What was preventing him from getting married?
Well, when he became a paraplegic at the age of 12,
ouch,
he was under his father's... insurance at a very big outfit, and he had to stay there.
Right.
Because not he actually had allied difficulties that would not be covered if he were to leave his father's family.
Because they would become pre-existing conditions.
And therefore, for the last, you know, whatever, how many years it's been, he could not even consider being married. And I know he's not unique in this. So the Affordable Care Act is changing his life. And why are these people trying to take that away and make the really millionaires, billionaires? Thank you so very much for where you are. Please don't go away from this anyway.
Okay, you got it, George. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Morning.
Hey, I'm so glad you're back on the morning time. Hey, I wanted to share with you this guy who you spoke to at your 9 o'clock hour. You know, people like him just infuriate me because if it wasn't for the affordable health care, I would not be able to have insurance because, unfortunately, I got sick and I was diagnosed with a pre-existing condition that was out of my control. And people like that guy who wants me not to have health insurance just pisses me off.
Yeah, I think the majority of us have a pre-existing condition, and Americans are waking up. And that's why I told David, I just don't think people are buying this line anymore. I really, really don't. I realize they're going to continue to try to peddle it. But, John, thank you for the call, and thanks for your comments. Mike in Beaufort, Missouri. Hey, Mike, you disagree with me?
Yes, sir, Mr. Hartman. Just a couple of quick things. You know, you were talking about them, you know, just changing, adding the two words. My suggestion would have been they read it ahead of time. Then if there would have been any questions from our so-called intelligentsia, they could have straightened it out.
Yeah, this thing was debated 16 ways to Sunday for months.
Let me tell you, I'll just tune out, then you can talk. The other thing is, you know, you talk about, well, some people are going to have to pay higher premiums, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I guess they just don't count. I guess it's just tough luck.
No,
it
is not that they don't count, Mike. It's that they are people who earn over $60,000 or $70,000 a year. And that's where you're going to see there's essentially a donut hole here. Setting aside the red state donut hole where Republicans are intentionally screwing working poor people, people who make more than, for example, in Louisiana, if you make more than $3,000 a year, you no longer qualify. You're too rich to qualify for state Medicaid. But in Louisiana, if you make less than $12,000 a year, you don't qualify for the Obamacare subsidies. So people who are actually working, making more than $3,000 and less than $12,000 a year, have no access to health insurance because Bobby Jindal will not expand Medicaid in that state. Well, there's a similar donut hole for wealthy people. And I'm not talking about genuinely wealthy people. I'm talking about the upper middle class, although it probably applies to the Koch brothers as well. And that is that if you're making more than $70,000 or $80,000 a year, you no longer qualify for any kind of subsidies under Obamacare. And, yeah, your insurance rates may go up somewhat. And small businesses, I mean, we saw our insurance rates go up almost 30% last year, which is not because of Obamacare. They've been going up long before Obamacare. But the reality is that those are the folks who can afford it. And what they're paying, and it's not like they're being taxed or penalized because they can afford it, is that they're actually paying the cost of what they're getting. And, you know, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with saying to somebody who can afford to buy their own health insurance, you're going to have to buy your own health insurance in the marketplace at the price that the market is setting it? Hello? Mike? I guess Mike is gone. Rudy in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Rudy.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I love the show, man, and I have a ton of respect for you. But damn it, man, you can't let guys like that just get on and just... How are you going to replace something and don't have something that's equal or better? That just blows my mind.
Yeah, I agree, and that's why I like having those conversations with people like David, because I think it demonstrates not to speak to David because he's not here to defend himself, but I think that the general Republican line or conservative line on this stuff of just let the free market decide, that's that question that Wolf Blitzer asked Ron Paul back in the Republican primary debates. You know, you got a 30-year-old guy who's uninsured and he's been hit by a car and he's dragging himself to the curb or into the ER. And what would you say to him? And some guy out in the audience yells, "Let him die." I mean, that's
and also And also, Mr. Hartman, this conversation that these guys were having back when President Obama was being inaugurated, it was deep into him just having a legacy. These guys felt like America turned their back on them. So they're wreaking havoc on America. So if people in America, if we don't open our eyes as to what's really going on in this country, we're in trouble.
Yeah. This is, you know, we have had a war on people of color for centuries. We've had a war on Native Americans for centuries. We've had a war on women for centuries. The Republicans are reviving all these things. And now, you know, I think what provoked the Tea Party is that they've also put middle-class white people in their crosshairs. Rudy, thank you for the call. Well said. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we'll see where all this goes. Stick around. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 28 minutes before the hour. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I LOL'd when your guest accused you of being vague and then spouted the great specificity of the free market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just to remind him that the free market is still out there. If you don't want to use Obamacare, you're free to walk into any insurance company and tell them you want to buy health insurance, and they'll sell it to you.
Yeah.
After you fill out 100 forms and about 500 questions of your health history. So
right.
If you don't want to use Obamacare and you don't like the rates you get, go buy it on your own. It's still there.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about the if this decision were to ultimately turn, you know, to the great the exact wording of the law, how would any given state appeal to the federal government and say that we're unable to set up an exchange? Either it's too burdensome, we don't have the resources, or we don't know how, for whatever, like kind of like what Oregon did.
Right.
And they would the federal government is obligated to help them because it's a federal law. So they're
well, it's actually in the law that the secretary of DHS will help, or not DHS, HHS will help the individual states establish these exchanges.
Well, and if not, then what purpose did the federal exchange ever serve? Which means, what was all the big brouhaha about the rough going when it first got started? If it never served any purpose to begin with,
well, other than possibly being for the District of Columbia, yes. It is suggested by some people, and this I saw this over at I think it was Talking Points memo yesterday. It was, and I think it was also posted on DemocraticUnderground.com. Was that there is a simple fix for this? And that is, if the Supreme Court agrees with D.C. Circuit Court and says, okay, if you're getting your health insurance through the federal exchange, you no longer get subsidies. So this guy in West Virginia who brought the lawsuit, excuse me, his price will go from $21 a year up to whatever somebody making, you know, 400% of poverty, whatever somebody making more than roughly $60,000 a year pays. In other words, basically they're going to have to pay the free market price, right?
Mm-hmm.
If that were to happen, it would make healthcare unaffordable for a lot of people who make less than $60,000 a year. And at that point, what the states could do is they could basically create a homepage and say, here is the Oregon Exchange.
Yeah.
This is the Oregon Exchange. Here's the Oregon Exchange homepage. Click here to get your healthcare coverage. You click there, and you are now on the federal page.
Exactly what I thought. This all ultimately, all these computer systems ultimately link together.
Right.
So this is it's so silly and so nonsensical.
Yeah.
I mean,
the only problem with that solution that I just laid out, Paul, is that Oregon would do that in a heartbeat, right? I mean, they tried to do an exchange and it didn't work, and so they defaulted to the federal exchange. Any state run by a Democratic governor or a Democratic legislature would do that, but the Republican states, which right now are saying to people who earn between $3,000 and $12,000 a year, screw you. Those Republican governors, the Scott Walkers and Rick Scotts and Rick Perrys of the world, those Republican governors will also say, we're not going to put a homepage up, even though it might only cost us, you know, $16 a year, you know, over at monster.com or whatever these, you know, .com, you know, we'll sell you a website.
Sure.
We're not going to do that because, you know, we think this is socialism and we don't care if, you know, 45,000 people a year die in the United States because they don't have health insurance. Tough luck. They should have been born with rich parents like the Koch brothers were.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the problem with this solution. So that's how the Supreme Court could make the situation even worse. Paul, thank you for the call. Curtis in Herman, Missouri. Hey, Curtis, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. How are you doing today?
I am well. You have an ACA story?
I do. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I have to say it angers me quite a bit when I hear these people bashing the Affordable Care Act and how we don't need it and how people don't like it and on and on, basically just mimicking Fox News talking point distortions. My husband, Mark, died right before the Affordable Care Act was put into place because he did not have insurance and he had a pre-existing condition. He died of a heart attack.
I'm sorry to hear that.
He was not, obviously couldn't put him on my insurance because we were a same-sex couple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he'd still be here today if he had insurance and was able to get to the doctor in a timely manner. So that's how it affects people.
Yeah. He was one of those 45,000 people in America every year who die because they lack health insurance that Harvard uncovered.
And the GOP says, screw you.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I got it. That's a real life story.
Yeah. Curtis, thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry. I sympathy for your loss. I don't know how to say it right, but thank you for sharing that story with us. It was meaningful. Michael in Madison, Alabama. Who does Tom think he is? Really?
Yeah, so exactly what I said. Who do you think you are, Sam? Just because I started out at 10,000. I worked my way up to 30,000. Now I'm up to a little over 80,000. Nobody gave me that money. So what made, and suppose I'm taking care of a sick parent. Suppose
Michael, let me figure out what you're upset about here. What I said is that if you make more than 400% of poverty, you no longer get government subsidies to buy your health insurance. You have to pay the rate that the insurance companies are charging in the open free market. What's your complaint about that?
What is my complaint about that is if you decide what I need to pay. And you always poke.
I'm not deciding it. United Healthcare is deciding it. Aetna's deciding it. Blue Cross Blue Shield is deciding it. If you're making $80,000 a year, Michael, you don't qualify for government subsidies, which means you have to pay the regular, normal retail price that these guys charge. I don't get why you're attacking me for the fact that you have to buy insurance from Aetna.
Why you keep poking your hand in the Koch brothers' eyes? What about Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi? Harry Reid's so deep up Vegas's butt, they turned the corner.
So you don't have an answer for my question. What upsets you about why are you saying who do I think I am for telling you that gee you're going to have to pay the retail price? Do you want a subsidy? Is that what you're saying? That you want me to subsidize your health insurance because you make $80,000 a year? Is that what you're saying? Oh, he's gone. Okay. All right, Kathy in Orange, Connecticut. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Number one, I heard a speaker a while ago. He was a Republican, and he did what Republicans do. The health care issue is a very complicated issue, and you really have to study it to see why they did it, how it's come along. And what he did is he slipped in the lie that said that the spiraling cost of health care had gone down before Obamacare, and that is simply not true.
Right.
In the years of the George Bush administration, health care costs in this country went up by a factor of 10.
Really?
And, you know, yes, they did. I was listening to Zach Emanuel talk about this, about the real point of health care.
Right.
Of having
he wrote the book on it.
To stop this
quite literally.
And, you know, maybe his view is biased, but I'm always listening to the health care program at one of the universities where I work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a really important thing for our country. If we don't want to, our country is off the chart when it comes to the cost of health care. as part of our GNP. And we end up with, if we don't contain it, we're going to have only healthcare costs that we can pay for. The other thing that I wanted to say is that I'm one of the ones that is in the free market. I earn enough money that I have to pay for my own insurance. And if we had had a single payer option, everyone would have been insured under this.
Right.
But the insurance companies have such a strong lobby. My insurance since Obamacare has gone up about $200. Mm. I don't get any doctor visits covered or prescription drugs covered.
Right.
Basically, I'm paying $200 more for catastrophic, you know, some catastrophic thing that might happen to me.
Right. Well, and also for the fact that your insurance company can no longer dump you if you get sick. That actually increases
their
costs.
I am not complaining about this. I understand the structure of the thing.
No, I'm in the same situation. We're, you know, mm-hmm. as an employer who provides not only my employees insurance, but I am on the exact same policy as all my employees, you know, as the employer, because we pay 100% of our employees' health insurance. My costs have gone up, and arguably that just comes right out of my paycheck. And or out of my employees. Actually, it's coming out of my employees' paycheck, arguably, because it's part of compensation. But we're all paying more, and I get
right.
it.
And
we're all paying more because the cost of insurance has actually gone up somewhat because the Affordable Care Act says you can't screw your customers anymore, and if insurance companies can't screw their customers, it costs a little bit more to do business. I don't have a problem with that.
I feel that they had such a strong lobby when they were writing this thing. That they really benefited from it, the insurance
right.
companies.
Right.
Instead of being the ones who also share the burden to some degree, I don't see it that way. You know, I think that my insurance went up about $200 for me personally per month.
Right.
And I'm not someone who even uses my insurance, kind of, you know.
Right.
I'm not sick.
You're a healthy person.
So, you know, I don't know. The whole thing is the Republicans are just so successful at lobbying for their ideas that we end up with this thing that's...
Well, they're good at selling bumper stickers, you know? It's a mess, it's too many pages, it's too complicated, whatever. It's but the reality is that millions of people are covered now. Kathy, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more Anything Goes Summer right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Roger in Van Nuys, California. Hey, Roger, you are frustrated about Democrats?
Yes, Tom. You know, this discussion about the health care and about the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. it's just another example of the frustration I have with the Democratic candidates and the congressmen and the Senate for not going on the attack. We spend all our time being defensive.
Some of them are, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about this political year, and it gets way too little coverage, it's been covered in wonky places like Politico, is that a few of the Democrats who are running on Obamacare, I supported Obamacare, I want you to have health insurance coverage, I want to expand Medicaid in our city or in our state, or those kind of things, those Democrats are doing very well.
Right, but here's the question. Why doesn't every candidate for this fall say to their opponent, exactly what policy do you support for the middle class, the working poor, and the poor?
Well, then they pull out their fairy dust, their magic pixie stuff. They say, I support the free market.
Well, that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that's very easily seen through.
Yeah.
I mean, when you say specific things, specific policies, we know that you're for subsidies for the energy companies. We know that you're for subsidies for the large farm industry.
The defense industry, the national security, the spy industry.
Specific things we know you're
private
for.
Private prison industry.
What are the specific things that you are for everyone else? And they have no answer.
Right.
But I don't hear that from the Democratic candidates. I don't hear them say, listen, you want to get rid of most of the food stamps? Then raise the minimum wage. Very simple.
Yep.
You want to have Social Security okay for the forever? Then everyone should pay 100% into Social Security,
right, the same
not
percent.
Up to $100,000.
Right. Blow off the cap. Yep.
Right. Very simple. Social Security is good forever then.
Yep. Not only is it good forever, but it would produce enough of a surplus that it could cover the shortfalls that Medicare is looking at over the next 15 years.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really quite remarkable how just, you know, these very simple fixes that would not affect the economy at all. Medicare, right now, if you make more than, what is it, $113,000 a year, is that the cap for Social Security?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's in that neighborhood. Maybe it's up to $115,000 this year. It changes every year, so I always get confused. But, or it's hard to keep track of.
Your opponent, you know, if you have multimillionaire donors who are only paying up to 100% for their Social Security, what does that say about you?
Right. Yeah, and the point is that if somebody's making $1 million a year, they're only paying Social Security tax on the first $114,000, and the next roughly $900,000, they're not paying a penny on. Whereas the guy who's out there fixing the street, you know, who's working for $30,000 a year for the city, or the person who's working at McDonald's for $15,000 a year, or at Walmart, they're paying every single penny that they take home. Even if they're so poor that they qualify to pay no federal income tax whatsoever, still they are paying that Social Security tax on every single penny. But in Bill Gates' tax bracket, you know, instead of paying that 3 or 4%, whatever it is that the person working at McDonald's is paying and has to pay, there's no exceptions, no exemptions. You know, Bill Gates says, well, you know, second million, third million, fourth million, tenth million, not at all. It's incredible. Roger, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Adam in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the mic. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Yeah, I just want to comment. I'm in a household income of $90,000, and I purchased health care through the Affordable Care Act. And before this, I actually paid 100% of my premium, and now I'm still paying 100% of my premium. Don't qualify for any subsidies.
Right.
But my insurance changed from $1,700 a month to $600 a month is what I'm paying now.
Really?
Yes.
For roughly the same insurance policy, or are you getting a much poor? Okay.
It is not the same insurance policy. The way that the insurance policy is set up, I have a very high deductible. I have a $10,000 deductible.
Right.
But if I – that are a $10,000 out-of-pocket total cost.
Right.
But the amount of money – I'm saving $1,000 a month on my premium.
Which is more than $10,000 a year.
Correct. So right. What I do is I take that $1,000 that I was paying my premium, I put it in my bank account. And in case something happens to me or my family, I have that money.
Well, and in fact, I think that you could put that in a tax-free health savings account, not even have to pay income tax on that money.
Correct. I mean, yeah, I could at that point, but you know, I only need that $10,000 a year, and after these, you know, that $10,000 to sit there.
Right.
If I don't use it, it is then my money.
Right. So the Affordable Care Act net. For you earning $90,000 a year plus has basically cut your health insurance costs by $2,000 a year.
Correct.
The difference between $10,000 that's your deductible and $12,000 that you're setting aside, that you're saving. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Adam, thanks for sharing your story with us. Judy in Issaquah, Washington. Hey, Judy.
Hi. I just want to share with you my experience, and I want to speak to all of the naysayers about the ACA.
Okay.
I have a pre-existing condition now. Previously, I was extremely healthy. I've had breast cancer twice.
Yikes.
And it was due to HRT, hormone replacement therapy, back when they said, statistically have 1% chance of getting cancer, but it's really good for your heart.
Right.
Okay.
A lot of that going around, you know.
Pardon me?
A lot of that going around, particularly since Suzanne Summers popularized it aggressively about a decade ago.
I had a settlement from the pharmaceutical company.
Really?
So I know, personally, they won't admit it, of course, they caused my cancer.
Wow.
And what does this do for me in addition to going through chemo and all the rest of it? Now I have a pre-existing condition.
Right.
And would they cover me after two rounds with breast cancer? Not likely.
Yeah.
Not likely. And there are hundreds of thousands of women in this same situation.
Right. And the Affordable Care Act said to the insurance companies, you can no longer kick people like you, Judy, off their insurance policies.
Exactly. Yep. And as I say, my point being, I didn't even cause my problem.
Right.
You know, it wasn't right. genetic. It wasn't anything like that.
Right.
It was caused, and by the way, let me give a little thanks to Papantonio.
Uh-huh.
I had always suspected that it was the hormone replacement pills.
Right.
I kept searching on the net back when it was relatively new unfortunately, I was looking for class action. It's not. It's individual cases.
Right.
He had a person on his show, a lawyer, who handled these cases.
Uh-huh.
And so I followed up and called the show and got led to another attorney and another attorney in Oregon.
Uh-huh.
That's how I got my settlement, was due to Papantonio's show.
That's impressive. That's a great story.
And one of these days I must try to contact him and let him know.
Well, I'll pass it along to him if you'd like to.
But he led me to the attorney.
That's great.
Indirectly.
That's great. That's great. Pap will be on our show tomorrow. I'll try to remember to pass your story along to him.
Kudos for me. And whether there were other women that found out the same way, I have no idea. But I did.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing there were, because, you know, Pap's got a pretty good audience for his show. Judy, I want to get some more calls in. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. John in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about the health insurance market not being a free market?
Yeah. When I called shopping around for individual policies,
right,
they basically explained to me that the price is the same no matter what your health circumstances are, whether you're a man or a woman, and the only distinction that affects the price is whether or not you smoke. So if they are not able to...
Well, your age can also be considered.
Say that one more time.
Your age can also be considered.
Okay. But regardless, the fact that there's even a price control in there shows that it's not a free market. So
no, it's not. Well, okay, let's define terms here, John. I agree with you. Okay, now let's define terms. If in a football game, when the NFL plays football, is that a free football game? In other words, are the players on both teams free of external coercion?
Players on both teams free of external... I'm not sure I follow you.
Are they able to play football without being, you know, externally influenced? You know, I would say that a non-free football game is where one of the players on one of the teams is in it with a bookie, and he's trying to throw the game, something like that. I mean, my point is that...
Well, that would be illegal.
Yeah, exactly.
If that in business, that would be illegal, too.
That's my point.
Between market fluctuations based on supply, demand, and how you set your price versus
correct.
The legal
So the
price.
NFL is a great example of survival of the fittest, a free market, but all markets, by definition, in order to be a market, have to have boundaries. And those boundaries have to be enforced by courts. And in the case of the NFL, they have boundaries about how you can draft your players, how you can, you know, how you can pass and catch, how, you know, what happens when you step out of bounds. What happens if you hit somebody the wrong way? The same play, the exact same thing has happened in the insurance marketplace. We have, as a society, said we are going to define the marketplace with these boundaries, just like the NFL has boundaries for the players in the NFL. And the insurance companies are playing in that marketplace. And I would argue to you that that is a free market, or there's no such thing as a free market. John, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And a couple of questions came up in the as in the echo of my rant yesterday. It wasn't even a rant. I think it was more like a college course on the history of bilateral therapies and their use for treating post-traumatic stress disorder and the nature of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I just wanted to address those because I just find this stuff absolutely fascinating, which is why I've actually written two books about it. But the main one is Walking Your Blues Away. And I think it's one of the most important books I've ever written. And there are many other good books on this topic as well. I'm not trying to pitch my book at you. It's just that, you know, writing the book helped make me an expert on the topic. And so that's why I'm going to tell you, you know, everything I'm going to tell you, you don't need to buy the book, right? But there are also books on EMDR, which Francine Shapiro, if I'm remembering her name correctly, invented or came up with and trademarked and other kinds of bilateral therapies. The beginning point for this is that post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, the hallmark characteristic of PTSD is that people remember a past event as if it was today, as if it happened today. If a person has that as a presenting symptom, that is the most significant factor that says this is actually PTSD. And the reason for that is there's this part of the brain, the hypothalamus, or the hippocampus, excuse me. I was using the wrong word yesterday. I was saying hypothalamus. It's the hippocampus. The hippocampus that is a one-day scratch pad for the brain. And it doesn't know time. It doesn't know past and future. It only knows now. And so if something happens today, whatever happens today, I mean, everything that's happening to all of us today, tonight when we go to sleep, assuming that we don't take sleeping pills that prevent REM sleep, and this is one of the reasons why regular frequent use of the more powerful sleeping pills actually can produce anxiety disorders and a whole range of psychiatric problems, is because you don't get to process your day when you sleep, and they also impair memory, long-term memory, well, short-term memory as well. What happens is when you go to sleep at night, as best anybody can tell, is that the hippocampus says, okay, here's what happened during the day, and it just dumps that stuff into the brain, into the thinking brain, the whole brain. The hippocampus is this little tiny part of the brainstem, or the lower brain. And the whole brain says, okay, how do I make sense out of this? Well, we'll put this over here, and we'll put this over there, and we experience this as dreaming. And the brain sorts information by emotion rather than by logic, and it's a whole fascinating subset of neurolinguistic programming, of NLP in there that is fascinating to teach, but it's beyond the scope of today's conversation. The problem that produces PTSD comes when the hippocampus experiences, when a person experiences something during the day that is so horrible that the rest of their brain can't deal with it. Now, that's so horrible is an entirely subjective experience. Two different people might see a car accident, and one will be absolutely traumatized by it to the point that they will have post-traumatic stress disorder for years, and another person will just say, oh, yeah, it was a car accident. So it, you know, whether it's, you know, being the victim of some kind of abuse, or whether it's the you know, having somebody die, or whether it is, you know, being in war and being shot at, or shooting somebody, killing, taking a life of another person, being part of a company, a group of people that took the lives of other people, whatever it may be. It is something that that one individual at some, you know, moral cognitive level can't handle while they're asleep. And so the hippocampus tries to dump it into the brain. When the person falls asleep, the brain says, no way, I'm not taking that. You just hang on to it. And the next day, the person wakes up, and the emotions associated with that experience are just as fresh as they were the day before. And then that night they go to sleep, and the hippocampus tries to dump it. And the brain says, I ain't taking it. You keep it. And the next day they wake up, and that memory is just as fresh as it was the day before. And that continues day after day after day for months and then years. And that's post-traumatic stress disorder. So what we've learned is over the years is that one of the ways – now, this is not a cure-all. This isn't, you know, instant – this doesn't work for everybody. But it works a lot for, I would say, most people. What we know is that if you can get a person to touch the edge of that memory, not, don't try to digest the entire thing all at once, but touch the edge of that memory while they are engaging in a task that alternately stimulates the left hemisphere of the brain and the right hemisphere of the brain. And the way that Franz Anton Mesmer taught us back in the 1770s, and then James Braid in the 1830s when he renamed mesmerism as hypnosis, and the Sigmund Freud did up until 1897, and you'll recall my telling you the whole story about why Freud stopped hypnosis yesterday, and Milton Erickson brought it back in the 1950s. I couldn't remember his last name yesterday, just popped into my brain. And Milton Erickson, you know, his work became the basis of Richard Bandler and John Grindler's work in inventing NLP that brought this stuff forward, is that it doesn't necessarily need to be just moving your eyes from side to side looking at a pocket watch. That it can be literally walking, which is a bilateral activity where you're going left, right, left, right, left, right, if your hands are swinging and they're free. And there's a whole lot of other ways to do it. Freud used to rub people down the side of their bodies, down their arms or down their chest if it was a man, alternate sides, left, right, left, right. I have a friend who's writing a book right now about this kind of therapy where he's suggesting you just can stand and move from left foot to right foot. I've been with Native Americans and with Aboriginal people in Africa where dancing is basically, it's not anything like anything you'd see in a dance club in the United States. It's people standing in very orderly fashion, sometimes in a line, and they're simply moving from left foot to right foot, left foot to right foot, left foot to right foot, standing in place. And they do it for hours. This is bilateral therapy. These are all ways. And while engaged in this bilateral therapy, in this bilateral activity, you then the person then takes on a little tiny bit of the memory and takes increasingly larger pieces of it, and over a period of time, and it can be, for some people, it's as little as a half hour. For some people, it takes days. But over time, they process that memory and diminish its intensity in the hippocampus and move it into the cortex, into the thinking part of the brain, where that night it's able to be processed and stored, and the experience that people will tell you the next day or 2 days later, or 3 or 4 days later, in some cases a week or a month later, is when you ask them, where is that memory? They used to say, it's right here in front of me. And now they say, oh, it's about 10 feet behind me, and it's black and white. It's in my past. So what, you know, this is what I shared with you yesterday, and when I learned this, I wrote this book, Walking Your Blues Away. And the questions that came up are a couple of questions. One, does this apply to depression or anxiety? And I've got an answer for that. I'll give you after the break. And the other is, can blind people do this? And, you know, I think given the description that I just gave about, you know, how you can even just stand in place and move from side to side, it should become fairly obvious or evident that, yes, blind people can do this as well. And because, you know, it doesn't require eyes moving from side to side. It just requires activating the left side of the brain, right side of the brain, left side of the brain, right side of the brain. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. And it's anything goes summer.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I'll take your calls on whatever topic you'd like. We can continue to talk about the Affordable Care Act, the insanity of the Republicans. I've got blame everything on Ronald Reagan. I got 100 things we can blame on Reagan. You can all kinds of stuff. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I want to finish that rant when our commercial stations rejoin us. So Jesse, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network down in Miami, Florida. You wanted to talk about the morality of investigative reporting. Do I have that right, Jesse?
Yeah, you do.
Go for it.
It's very important because watching the treatment of the MSNBC reporters of late, it looks like they reached their level of frustration and they're ready to go. Well, the lady was saying this morning on Amy Goodman that she's a moderate. But
right.
It's obvious that how can you be moderate or neutral when you're dealing with evil? So the important point, if investigative reporting is going to jump that morale line, I would say is, okay, a lot of people are burned down on hearing what's negative, what the problem is. Now a lot of people, they're going to, what's the next thing for her or this other guy to do is report the solution.
Yeah.
And the best solution really is taking control of our money. If Tahibi... Paul Grass, if I got his name right, reporting on these bad economic kings, somebody need to get the report on the solution for Warren and Bernie to rally the people.
Yeah, and Bernie's got a lot of good solutions, and so does Elizabeth Warren. I don't disagree with you. I do want to, though, just speak to your point of investigative reporting. Investigative reporting by the big networks died in 1996. It died when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. And arguably it died back in 1987 when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine. But, you know, shortly thereafter, the news divisions came up under the control of the entertainment divisions. They went from being money-losing operations for the network to money-making operations for the network. You saw the creation of news-only cable networks that were purely for-profit, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, excuse me. And along with this comes the appearance of news, the appearance of a lack of bias. But you will never hear a conversation on MSNBC about net neutrality, that particularly one that calls out Comcast, because Comcast owns MSNBC. You won't hear that on NBC. You know, it could be the biggest issue in America, and frankly, I think it is one of the biggest issues in America. They're not going to discuss it. You're never going to hear a discussion about media consolidation on CNN. You're not going to hear this on any of the networks, frankly. You're not going to hear a conversation about free trade on any of the big networks that have corporate control, which is all of them. There's a whole bunch of topics that are basically verboten. You know, they might dance around the edge of it by saying, well, yeah, we're in favor of fair trade, not, you know, but... You know, but you're not going to hear nobody in the media is going to be doing the investigative reporting that like Lee Fong does over at Republic Report and for so many other great places for the nation. So many of those stories will never make it into the corporate media because it is the corporate media, not because they're not good stories. And I think you're absolutely right, Jesse, with this this woman who CNN canned and MSNBC canned. And then there was a guy that CNN canned. You know, he was reporting from the crash site, he was reporting from Gaza Strip, and they pulled him out. You know, and then the listeners started yelling and screaming, and they put him back. But I mean, it's like there are limits on what can be covered by the corporate taskmasters. Jesse, thanks for the call. Thanks for the point is really well made. We'll be right back. So anyhow, the principal ways that post-traumatic stress disorder is dealt with, the goal of all of the various therapies is to incrementally take a memory that the hippocampus can't get rid of because the rest of the brain won't take it and get it out of the hippocampus. And the two principal ways that this is done are, number one, with bilateral therapies like EMDR and others that I described to you before the break. And the second one is giving people drugs that numb them enough that they can process this stuff without freaking out. These are typically the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or benzodiazepine drugs like Valium, the SSRIs or things like Prozac. They give people these drugs, and then under the influence of the drug, they do psychotherapy where they revisit the memory, but now they're basically numbed to the point that they can process it. And both of these techniques demonstrate some success. And in fact, both of these techniques did demonstrate a fair amount of success, but it's got to be dealt with. With regard to depression and anxiety disorders, and I write about this in I read about it in Walking Your Blues Away. I also wrote about it in Healing ADD, which is really originally I wrote this as a book on neurolinguistic programming, and so it's like a whole bunch of different NLP techniques. And my publisher said nobody wants to read a book about NLP, but you've got a couple of bestsellers. Time Magazine had just done a story about my first book on ADD. He said, everybody wants to know about ADD and they want to hear about it from you. So rewrite this book talking about how you can use these NLP techniques to help people who have been wounded by growing up having ADD in a public school system. And so it's called Healing ADD, but it's really an NLP book. And what I point out in both these books, and this is, again, not unique to me. Read the readings of Robert Diltz Richard Bandler or John Grinder or any of, Connie Ray Andreas. I mean, there's some really good stuff out there. Is that anxiety tends to be a future-centered disorder, and depression tends to be a past-centered disorder. In other words, people who experience depression chronically are constantly remembering past events for which they feel shame, typically shame, but one of the dark emotions associated with the past. They may not even remember specifically what the event is, but there's something there that keeps pulling them back. And it really needs to be treated as if it was PTSD. I mean, it can be treated using bilateral therapies or, cognitive behavioral therapy associated with pharmaceuticals or even without pharmaceuticals, a variety of these. But it's basically a person constantly revisiting their past. And so for many people, just that understanding is enough for them to get past their depression because they learn how to live in the present. Living in the present is, and if you want more on this, look up mindfulness or vipassana is the Indian word, the Hindu word for it. But vipassana training, mindfulness training, is learning to live in the present. And there's a very simple exercise that Milton Erickson's wife came up with for actually going to sleep. But it's a great exercise for simply becoming present in the here and now, which cuts the anchor to the past and diminishes or in many cases ends clinical depression. And that is to simply come to the moment. And the way you come to the moment is by noticing different senses in a circular fashion, in a repeating fashion. So you notice what you're seeing right now. Notice the colors. Notice the brightness. Notice the shape of things. Notice what you're seeing. And then notice what you're hearing. The sound of my voice. The space between the words, the tonality, the other sounds in the room, or wherever you may be. Just notice the sea of sound that you live in. And then notice what you're feeling. Are your shoes tight? Are you sitting? Do you feel the weight of your body on your butt? Or are you laying down? Whatever you may be doing, notice the feelings, the sensations in your body. What we're doing is these are called modality shifts. We're going through the sensory modalities. There's basically six of them. And notice what you're smelling right now. Notice what you're tasting, what's in your mouth. And notice your sense of balance, the vestibular system, your inner ear. In other words, your relationship to vertical and horizontal. Those are the six senses that we have direct access to and we can immediately notice. And then just go back to noticing what you're seeing. And then go through them. And Betty Erickson's technique was to go through these things three times. And if you do that as you're laying in bed trying to fall asleep, you will fall asleep. You put yourself into a hypnotic trance, essentially. But if you just do it once, while you're here and now right now, it brings you to the present. There's nothing I know of. And I learned this the first time I learned this, it was at a Soto Zen Center in Atlanta, Georgia, where Louise and I used to go every Sunday, and we would sit for a half hour, and, I mean, literally just sit facing a wall all around a room, everybody sitting on a cushion facing the wall, and you sit there silently for a half hour with your eyes open, looking down your nose at whatever happens to be on that wall. It was a stone wall. And just notice as stuff comes up in your brain. And the guy who taught me how to do this, he said, the first thing you want to do before you sit is you want to become present. And to become present, what you do is notice what you're seeing, notice what you're hearing, notice what you're feeling, notice what you're smelling and tasting, notice your relationship to the room. And just essentially say to yourself, I am here now. And constantly try to keep coming back to that. Every time your mind wanders off into some thought train about, you know, what's going to happen. So depression is when the past intrudes. Anxiety is when the future intrudes. Anxiety is when people imagine a horrible future and they imagine it in the present. And so the solution for anxiety is essentially the same as it is for depression, which is become present. And then if there is something in the past or something in the future that is, you know, a real trigger, you can deal with it with bilateral therapies. You can deal with it with a variety of forms of psychotherapy. And some people even deal with it with psychedelics. Yeah, we'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
End of Dr. Tom for the day. We'll be back to taking your calls right after the break. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, we've got topics all over the place on people on all a whole variety of topics here on the board. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Bob.
Thank you.
You wanted to testify about something?
Be in there and live long. Stay with us.
I'll do my best.
I'd like to bring attention to somebody that's in my... in my area, and he's a guy that was in journalism. He was on a mainstream television in Tulsa years back, and now he's with RSU TV, Claremore, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Sam Jones, wonderful journalist, recently suffered a heart attack, because I understand he's still doing good work. He's one of the few journalists left around here. Anyway, I just want to bring attention to that, and then. I want to say what you're saying about walking the blues away, it works. A lot of this stuff you're talking about with depression and all the stress that people are dealing with, anxiety and so forth, walking works. Being in tune with nature, what you're saying about dancing, it goes to music. I write songs, and it goes to music.
Yep.
Music does that too.
Music is bihemispheric because you process music in your right temporal lobe and you process the words in your left temporal lobe, and that's why music affects us in a deep and profound way, because it engages both hemispheres of the brain at the same time.
Yeah, it's very integrative. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you bringing attention to it and so forth. And another thing, my dad passed away just here a couple of years ago, and he was a therapist. I saw his career be destroyed. At the same time, I was in college trying to get a degree in psychology and education. He was working in psychology, and I saw how the Reagan administration and all that cronyism it still destroys the whole field of psychology and education, and it keeps
cut
from really understanding what healing is.
Yeah, they certainly cut funding for it.
Back to how the economy is run. And what we're going to have to do to survive in the future.
Yeah.
And how the topics there, climate change, economy, fuel, food.
Industrial hemp.
All the things we have to have, discussions that would ensure that we did have that future generations, those discussions are all swept under the rug, much like you mentioned. But we've got to make room for those discussions, whether or not they're popular or not.
Yeah.
And I just appreciate.
Okay. Well, Bob, thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. It's great, always great to hear from you. Industrial hemp, yes. Dimitri in San Francisco, The Big Lobotomy?
Yes, sir. Have you read that article?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
Oh, well, kudos, another kudo to Mike Papantonio. He brought it to my attention during one of his Ring of Fire shows. 6/22/14, I believe, is the date.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by Paul Glastris and Haley Sweetland Edwards. It's in this month's version of Washington Monthly, but if you do a Google search, it'll pop right up.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, the thrust of the article is a synopsis of the systematic dismantling of the legislative vetting and review infrastructure that was presided over by Sensenbrenner when the Republicans took over the House
mm-hmm.
in 1995. They essentially gutted the professional legislative support staff that their function was to vet and review legislation to make sure that it was all the I's were dotted. And
is this the was this what was called the Congressional Research Service, or is it something else?
Well, they
or is that part of it?
That's part of it. They cut the GAO funding and staff by a third.
Wow.
They killed off the Office of Technology Assessment entirely, and the Congressional Research Service, their funding and staffing was cut by a third as well.
Wow.
And what it did was precipitate a brain drain of some of the best and brightest of the lawyers, economists, and investigators who work for committees rather than individual.
So this is why, Dimitri, if I may, it sounds like this is why we get legislation like Gramm-Leach-Bliley or the Commodity Futures Modernization Act in 99 and 2000. You know, basically stupid brain-dead legislation that empowered the banks to crash our economy, among many, many other things, because now we have faith-based legislation rather than fact-based legislation because the fact-checkers got fired by the Republicans in 95. Is that a good summary of it?
That's it precisely. And now, you know, we're left with legislation by lobbyists and think tanks, and we're get stuck with imposters like Gohmert and Bachman.
Right. And this is how we end up with the Affordable Care Act having a typo in it that is being taken to the Supreme Court now.
Precisely. It's
because the legislative support is gone. Yeah.
Exactly. Serendipitous that I read this article just a couple of days ago, and you're discussing the topic today, or the courts actually brought it to all of our attention. But
yeah.
I'd really appreciate it if you could review the article. I think it's worthy of not just a rant on your part, but a more extended dissertation, because it's extremely important, I believe. And it's just that every time I hear one of these Republicans, one of these guys like you had on right off the top of the show, you know, he's not just a Kool-Aid drinker. He did a belly flop in a big tub of the stuff. You know, every time they're jumping up, I hear one of these guys jumping up and down talking about, well, government doesn't work and we should shrink it. Well, that's what they've been doing, and this is the result of
this is the predictable result of it. Dimitri, I got to move along, but thank you. I will look for the article, The Big Lobotomy, How Republicans Made Congress Stupid. I'm going to check it out. Thanks, Dimitri. Rick in Fort Thomas, Kentucky. Hey, Rick, what's up? Rick, it says here you are an Airfort flight nurse. Are you listening? Okay, Rick, you got to listen to your phone, not your radio. So I'll put you on hold here, and Danielle can check and see if you're actually there or not. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, Tom.
Oh, great.
Just remember, I'm on magic jacket. It's like a walkie-talkie, so I have to stop speaking in order to be able to hear what you say.
Okay.
Over.
Okay. Over to you, Johnny.
listen, I like that bilateral theory. There's a lot of interesting concepts to that. And I have my own theory as it relates to people that come out of prison or who leave military service from a war zone, if you're interested to hear it.
Sure.
It's really simple.
Yes, go for it.
What happens is you're in a war zone, all of a sudden the war is over, or your service is up, and you go home. They ship you home immediately. That's a big mistake. In the same way, it's traumatic to someone who's been in prison for 3 years or 5 years, and suddenly they're free. What you need to do is allow that individual to be able to come and go back and forth freely for a short period of time back to their prison cell and spend the night if they want, not as a prisoner but as a visitor. Same way with a soldier. Now, this costs money, so if you have private donations afford this, where they can fly back to Vietnam or Afghanistan as a private citizen after they grow their hair, so they could see and feel and taste the place they were at as a soldier, and they make sense of it. So that's a different kind of a bilateral approach.
Yeah, you're talking about
a splash of reality that's harsh, where it's surreal, but it's real.
Yeah.
So they don't freak out when they're home and they make no sense of the peace, calmness of home. They say, oh, that's what's going on at the other place, too. So I'm safe.
Yeah, that makes, Johnny, what you're recommending makes deep and profound sense to me. I don't know of any data that supports it, but just on a intuitive level, on a cognitive level even, it seems to totally make sense. What you're talking about basically is an integration process. When somebody makes a major transition from one environment to another, that particularly an environment that was filled with trauma, like prison or a battlefield, when they make that transition, it should not be abrupt. It should be gradual, or there should be opportunities for people to integrate the experience into their new life, and integrate their new life into that old experience in a way that doesn't create that kind of blockage that we call PTSD. I think you're right on. Johnny, thanks for the call. Rick in Fort Thomas, Kentucky. Hey, Rick, can you hear me now?
Hey, Tom. Sorry about that. Long time, first time.
Thank you.
I work in a huge urban trauma center, as well as being an Air Force flight nurse. And I thought I had come across something in one of the publications lately that had sort of re-examined the effects of MDMA or ecstasy on treating people with PTSD.
Yes.
And secondary to this is, the previous caller just kind of sparked something, that a lot of these units that go in country spend weeks or months training up to go in and are back within a matter of days usually. I know that we have the capability now of getting somebody from an injury on the battlefield back to definitive care in Germany within a matter of hours.
Right.
And then back to the U.S. from there. So there really is no decompression time. There is no time for these guys to process
right.
what they've been going through. And they've gone from this very tight sort of band of brothers mentality to all of a sudden being
part of society. Yeah, Rick, we're running out of time here, so I just wanted to toss this out really quickly. Yes, they are using ecstasy and other psychedelics, LSD. There's some experiments with mescaline and psilocybin as well. If you go back to the 60s, this is the work that Tim Leary was doing, that Richard Alpert was doing, who became Ram Dass. A lot of this work was being done at Harvard, MIT, Stanford. There was this giddiness, frankly, in the late 50s and throughout the early 60s about the potential of psychedelics to be transformational, not just for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, but a whole variety of psychiatric illnesses. And increasingly now they're going back and revisiting that because the science was pretty solid. And I think this is one of the reasons Aboriginal people use these substances. Where we go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And let me just toss a caveat on that. These are really powerful drugs, and they should only be used with professional or shamanic help. Welcome back. James in Spring City, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, first I'd just like to say congratulations on your award.
Oh, thank you. The Free Speech Award. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, I'd just like
honor.
To put this all in a nutshell so those that have invited to listen to your program to understand this. Basically, we're looking at what's gone on with our country the past 30 years is a hostile corporate takeover of our government using the conduits of lobbying and our media to convince us that what is going on is good for us. And basically what I'm trying to help people understand in my area, it's not. And if the use of the Republican Party is very detrimental to our society at this particular moment in time. And
it's a very good metaphor. Okay. I would track the I actually wrote a couple chapters about this in my book, The Crash of 2016. I track the beginning point to this to 1971. In 71, the idea of a political corporation, a politicized corporation, the idea of a corporation, lobbying for for political causes, giving money to politicians. It's pretty rare, and it was considered distasteful. And Lewis Powell wrote a memo to Eugene Sindor, who is his neighbor and the chairman or the president of the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And this letter, which we refer to now as the Powell memo, pointed out that in the late 60s, Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring, and Ralph Nader wrote a book called Unsafe at Any Speed. And these two people had ignited two movements, these consumer movements, one for consumer safety and the other for food safety and basically the ecology, the green movement. And that these movements were a threat to the profits of industry, and that government was starting to react to these things. And this was the early stirrings of the Environmental Protection Agency and whatnot. The government was starting to react to these things, and the outcome, the consequence of this would not be good for business. And business had to get active in politics. And that led directly, the next year, Powell was put on the Supreme Court by Nixon. And in 76, in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, Powell wrote the decision saying money is protected by the First Amendment as speech. And so rich people, and you know, like the people he worked for and the people he was referring to, have more speech than anybody else. And that's, I think, when the corporate takeover really began. I think it was put into place in 71 with the Powell memo, and the first major step of it was in 76 with Buckley versus Vallejo. But then the presidency of Ronald Reagan was the apotheosis of it. It was the you know, that's when they hit the plateau. Make sense?
And I absolutely concur. I absolutely do.
Yeah, I think you've got a great metaphor there, corporate takeover, because it's been, you know, largely big corporations, and, you know, it's, yeah. James, thanks a lot for the call. In fact, we should be talking about it more in that context, because, you know, where is the money coming from that's going into politics, at least on the Republican side? On the Democratic side, it's more often, if it's big money, it's typically a union, which is the workers. It's we the people. It's average working people. But if it's on the Republican side, it's coming out of big corporations and billionaires who got to be billionaires because of big corporations. And so to call it a corporate takeover, I think, is absolutely accurate. So anyhow, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a returning slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org about America's last political prisoner. Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Okay, there is a lot going on, and I think my favorite Tom Hartman piece of news here is that Harry Reid got on the Senate floor this morning, and he said that he wants to go after corporate citizenship scans. And the ones he went after is Walgreens. He said they have 8,200 drugstores in the United States. Now they want to purchase a similar kind of drug company in Switzerland. Then they want to make their headquarters in Switzerland, and he said that this would actually, that they are getting $16.7 billion from Medicare and Medicaid.
Wow.
And they don't want to pay U.S. taxes. Now, on the floor now is this Bring Jobs Home America, Home Act. It's being considered by the Senate. It's Senate Bill 2659. And it ends the loophole that allows companies to essentially expense off their moving expenses
offshore.
That's right.
You know, Nancy Pelosi passed legislation that did exactly that out of the House of Representatives, and it was filibustered by Republicans in the Senate, and that was back in the first year of the Obama
administration. Exactly. And now they also want to add a 20% tax credit to companies that are bringing back jobs to America.
Great.
Now, I would love to see a Republican vote against that bill. Man, and they're running for reelection. If I was a Democrat, I'd be having them for lunch.
Yeah. Well, the Republicans did vote against that back in 2009, I think it was, maybe 2010. But I think the times are different. I think people are far more wide awake right now. And also Democrats are getting more aggressive and
beating up Republicans.
Well, that would be nice. Okay. The White House is going to bring some private money to investment in infrastructure. They're making some announcements about that in the next couple of days. And they're having a Rural Opportunity Investment Conference. We don't know more details. We'll find them out a bit later.
So don't worry. The Koch brothers will fix your potholes.
I guess so. Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. Or...
You know, I'm curious. We'll
find out.
Maybe
they'll put you and me to work on it, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Secretary Kerry is in Israel. He went to the West Bank to meet with Prime Minister Abbas. He's meeting with Netanyahu. He's also going to meet with, well, he met yesterday with the President of Egypt. He's talked to several Mideast leaders. He's going to be meeting with the Secretary General in Jerusalem. Probably he's already done that. But the FAA extended that ban on the airlines for another 24 hours. Mm. They said missiles and things like that are going places right. They don't want them to go.
Right. That's a complex topic.
It is very complex. Okay. This Department of Transportation issued new regulations today. Senator Schumer was very, very happy about this. This has to do with those DOT, Department of Transportation. They're called 111 tank cars. They handle all kinds of fuel. They basically are saying they're going to give them 2 years to retrofit this so that they're much safer when they're going through there because they take crude oil. And, of course, this has to do with a lot of the oil that's coming from the Bakken in North Dakota.
Right. It's much more volatile and much more explosive.
Right. So they're very worried about that. And now if a train goes through a state, they have to notify that state that that train is going through.
Oh, this is the new regulation?
Yes.
When does it take effect?
I don't know when it takes effect, but they just issued it. So I imagine very, very quickly because until the 2 years, until they have to retrofit all these cars, then they have to notify. That has to happen immediately.
Right.
I think.
Right.
So, okay, so they have 2 years. All right. Now, it is interesting. The Government Accountability Office today was before one of the House committees, and this was on this report that people are faking IDs and all this kind of stuff to get free health care. And Joseph Crowley, I just love the guy from New York. He asked the head of the Government Accountability Office, he said, is the ultimate benefit to the criminal who would take the risk of defrauding the system to get a free colonoscopy?
Brilliant.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. So so that, I think, he basically said, the GAO said, the investigation is to identify future work in auditing Obamacare. That was a nice political way out of that.
Yeah. Amazing.
Okay. Your friend, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
My friend.
Yeah, I love to give you a little grief on that. He talked about Chairman Hal Rogers' plan, House appropriation, on the $3.7 billion request for the southern border. They're looking at $1.5 billion. As you know, there's all kinds of plans on the books. I just don't see, honestly, anything happening before they go on August recess. I just don't.
And for the record, before your comment goes Twitter viral, I have never met John Boehner. I don't know John Boehner. John Boehner is not a friend of mine, to paraphrase Lloyd Benson.
Right. Exactly. Okay. That's true.
Yeah.
All right. The Supreme Court yesterday decided, or I guess early this morning, that they're going to allow the execution of Joseph Wood of Arizona to go through.
Ooh.
The Ninth Circuit Court, you know how I feel about the death penalty.
Yeah.
The Ninth Circuit Court had said no until they can identify where these drugs are coming from. But the Supreme Court, unfortunately, is going to let that through. Yeah, I know.
I had Mike Farrell on for a half hour Monday night talking about
really?
This. Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
He does such great work with the death penalty.
I know. Talk about. A gun was recovered this morning. Somebody tried to bring a gun into the Cannon House office building. I mean, you wonder, what's wrong with people?
This is like the third time in 2 weeks. Is there some kind of epidemic of stupid going on in D.C.?
An epidemic of stupid. That's the best way to put it.
It's got to be contrails, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know,
Ukraine is saying that two of their fighter jets shot down by the rebels, supposedly. Who knows what's going on like that?
That does weaken the rebels' case that they don't know how to shoot down airplanes.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does. Yeah. Yes.
I think we're looking at drunken rednecks. You know, they got them in the Ukraine just like we got
them. Well, no, I understand. And if you give people access to weapons, I mean, who is getting weapons into Gaza?
Right.
And actually, what we know is that they're coming through, places like Iran. They're going to Sudan. Then they're going up, the Nile or whatever, into Egypt. And then they're going, without Egypt knowing about it,
Right into Gaza.
And
the same thing with ISIS in Iraq. You know, now in Mosul, they've said that the mannequins have to be veiled. And they're using American weaponry because we gave it to them when they were in Syria and they were the insurgents there. I mean, it's nuts. Anyhow, Ellen, we're out of time.
Thank you.
Got to wrap it up. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, free-found.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program today. And there's a couple of things I'd like to rant about, and then we'll pick up the phone lines and take your calls on our Anything Goes Summer here. But with regard to my rant, first, United Airlines has announced, or it's being reported that they will announce actually in October, that they're going to take their gate agents, the people who take your ticket when you get on the plane, and these are people who are unionized and make, you know, in the neighborhood of $40,000 to $50,000 a year. That's a decent middle class income in many parts of this country. They're going to take these folks and fire them in a bunch of cities and hire instead contractors. Subcontractors hire companies that pay their employees $9 to $12 an hour. So you know they're taking what $40,000 a year is around what $36 an hour or something. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to do that math. But in any case, they're taking people who are making a decent living and they're going to replace them with people who are making poverty wages. Now, why would United do that? Because this is the Walmart business model. The McDonald's fast food business model is now starting to explode across America. I mean, it got a lot of publicity over the last few months, particularly because of Occupy and because of the $15 minimum wage movement and the activity in Seattle. And what happened was all these big companies that hadn't been using the Walmart fast food business model said, "Whoa, look at this. We can do this. Holy cow." Now, let me explain. The Walmart fast food business model is really, really simple. You pay people a low enough wage that it's legal. It's above the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, but it's low enough that they are poor enough when they work for you that they qualify for food stamps and housing assistance and medical care. So the Walmart fast food business model is let's have part of the cost of our employees, those things that keep our employees alive, their food, their medical care, their housing, let's have those costs paid for by the taxpayers, and we can take the money that we would have otherwise paid those employees, and we can give it to our stockholders, and our executives can take a larger paycheck. This is called internalizing profits and socializing costs or externalizing costs. And companies all around the country, all around the United States, and this is something that you know, it's in most countries you can't do this. Because in most countries, the minimum wage has been indexed to inflation. If our minimum wage was indexed to inflation, right now it'd be about $12 an hour. Which means that most minimum wage workers would not qualify for food stamps. They'd only qualify if they had a very large family, a lot of kids, and they were the only worker in the house. Back in the 60s, in 68, which is the year that I'm referencing, that you, if you index to minimum wage workers, and in 68, I was one of them. I was a DJ at a local radio station, and I also worked at a gas station and at Bob's Big Boy. Back then, minimum wage workers earned enough that they did not qualify for food stamps. Nowadays, minimum wage workers, because we didn't index it to inflation, and the minimum wage is not $12 and something in change an hour. Instead, it's still only $7 an hour. Now, Walmart can do something here that they pretty much can't do in any other developed country in the world. And that is pay their workers so little that you and I, as taxpayers, if assuming that you have a job and you're paying taxes, that you and I are picking up the Walmart costs and the fast food costs. And this, you know, the math on this has been done. Congressional Democrats released a report earlier this year that suggested that American taxpayers are subsidizing every Walmart store in the country to the tune of $900,000 to $1.75 million per year per store by picking up these costs, these what would otherwise be direct costs for employment. If Walmart was paying their workers $15, $20 an hour, if they were paying what Costco pays, we would not be subsidizing them. But the Walton family's looking at this going, hey, we're only worth $100 billion. We need more! And the CEOs and the stockholders and, you know, everybody else. So this business model, you know, has Walmart's gotten away with it over the years. And the fast food industry adopted this about a generation ago and started doing this. And they've gotten away with it. And so now United Airlines is saying, hey, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We can get in on this thing. This is just wrong. And there's three different ways that we could break this down, that we could stop it. The first would be to simply raise the minimum wage. And in fact, the reason why the Obama administration proposed a $10.10 an hour minimum wage is that at that level, at $10.10 an hour, in most states in the United States, if you're a single person and you're earning that, you no longer qualify for food stamps and public assistance, most public assistance. So it breaks that business model. Which is why these companies are fighting against it so hard, why the Republicans that they own in Congress are refusing to even consider legislation to raise the minimum wage. And the Republicans control the House of Representatives, where all legislation has to originate. The second way that we could break this business model is to roll back Taft-Hartley, is to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act that was passed during the Harry Truman administration over his veto three times. To repeal Taft-Hartley, which created this carve-out for any state that declares that it wants to be a right-to-work-for-less state. And if you repeal Taft-Hartley, then you're operating under the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act of 1935. And what that says is that, you know, if it's card check on steroids. If a majority of people, if more than 50% of the people in a workplace say, I want to be in a union, you've got a union, and the employer can do nothing about that, they can't bust that union. And they cannot hire non-union employees. It's closed shop. And that would drive up wages, and that would break that business model. And the third way that we could break this business model, which is something that I've been suggesting for some time, actually all three of these are in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. The third way is to say, we're no longer going to give tax breaks of any kind to any corporation that has even one employee who qualifies for food stamps. If you have even one full-time employee who qualifies for food stamps, you no longer can take tax deductions for anything. You can't deduct your executive's meals. You can't deduct the cost of the private jet. You can't. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. I mean, you know, they're not going to do it as draconian as that. Maybe you could just say you can no longer deduct executive salaries. But I mean, you know, make it hurt. Recover that $1 million per Walmart. Recover that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars per McDonald's per Burger King, per, you know, whatever, per store, recover that money and say, we the people are no longer going to pay, you know, 30-40% a year cost to have an employee. That's your job. You're the employer. And if you're going to follow this business model, it takes advantage of the fact that Republicans have blocked raises in the minimum wage and the right to unionize over the last 30-40 years. If you're going to follow this business model, you know, we're going to take a bite out of your backside. We're going to recover that money. The amount of money that these corporations are earning every year, the amount of expense that they are dumping on we the people, according to researchers at the University of Illinois, at the University of California, Berkeley, is $243 billion a year. That's how much you and I are subsidizing Walmart and the fast food industry. And now United says, hey, we want to get in on this game. Who's going to be next?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll tell you who's going to be next. Everybody. Every country, every company in America that has the ability to do it is going to start busting their unions and dropping their wages. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cindy in Euclid, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Cindy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Bear with me on 2 points. I just wanted to repeat a quote from Senator Bob Packwood, Republican from Oregon in 1994.
Okay.
When the GOP blocked Clinton's health care reforms, he said, we've killed health care. Now we've got to make sure our fingerprints aren't on it. Sounds like a real American there.
Wow. What specifically was he referring to?
He was referring to the GOP blocking health care reforms by President Clinton.
Oh, this was Hillary Care, where Hillary Clinton had come up with something that was, you know,
right,
a step toward, actually it was sort of Obamacare with a public option built into it,
exactly,
as I recall.
And, they didn't want their fingerprints on what they did to the American people by blocking it.
Amazing. And Bob Packwood was considered one of the good Republicans. it's just incredible.
The second point, Tom, if you can bear with me, you recall the jobs bill that was heavily invested in infrastructure repair that was put down by the House of Representatives.
Right.
And I just wanted you to recall the first George Bush talking about privatizing the roads. My friend, one of my girlfriends dated a lobbyist who was involved with those sensors that you put on the windshield. And that's basically what they want. And I think that the jobs bill and destroying that and letting the roads go to hell is probably a good way to in try to promote this privatization of the roads. And as you recall, when Eisenhower had the road system built, it was a matter of national security. Still is, if you think about feeding people and so forth, even, you know, of course, if you wanted to bring weapons to the borders.
There's actually, Cindy, let me just correct that, because I'll be getting calls on this if I don't. The mythology, which I believed up until I started doing this show, and I repeated it on the air, and somebody called me on it, and I double-checked it. The mythology was that Eisenhower sold the highway system to America in the early 50s by saying every 100 miles there has to be a five-mile stretch to the straight, and that that can be used by planes to land, and if we ever go to war or we're ever attacked, this will become part of our aerial national security infrastructure, and so it was sold as a defense bill. Turns out that Eisenhower never said that. That sales pitch was never made. Eisenhower sold it based on, and this is really Republicans reinventing their own history. Eisenhower was a Republican. Republican Congress voted for this. Eisenhower sold, and this was back when Republicans used to run on the fact that they had increased the number of good union jobs. They had strengthened Social Security. I mean, read the 1956 Republican Party platform. It's mind-boggling. Eisenhower sold the national highway system as something that would increase commerce and put people to work. It was that simple. Just FYI.
Thank you for straightening.
Yeah. You're still there, Cindy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think it's important because people think that Republicans will only vote for things, or it used to be that Republicans would only vote for things if it had the military associated with it. And the fact of the matter is that in the 50s, the Republican Party of my father, they were fairly rational. You know,
Anyhow, Cindy, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for that Bob Packwood quote. He was, other than his propensity to grope his staff, which is a pretty pretty grim thing in and of itself, legislatively, he was not the worst Republican. Cindy, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Okay, the other thing I wanted to share with you just very quickly, and then we'll pick up your phone calls, was Andy Harris. Andy Harris, I went off on Andy Harris a week or so ago, and I know a lot of you called his office. And back when he had inserted into a must-pass piece of legislation in the House of Representatives, appropriations legislation, an amendment that would have ended the decriminalization of pot in Washington, D.C., which went into effect yesterday? No, it was a couple days ago. Anyway, it might have even been last Thursday or Friday. I think it was last Thursday, as I recall. But it's funny because I'm pretty sure it was Thursday, because Friday night Louise and I were having dinner at, it was Sunday night. We were having dinner at Dukem, which is this incredible Ethiopian restaurant here in D.C. It's almost as good as Dalos, the best Ethiopian restaurant in the world. But Dalos is in Portland, Oregon. And anyway, we were having dinner at Dukem, and they've got an outdoor sitting, and we were sitting outside, and twice somebody walked by smoking dope, and you could just sit there, smell it. Oh, hey, look at that. Because D.C. dropped the penalty down to $25 in a parking ticket, right? No criminal record, for up to an ounce. And so Andy Harris inserted into this legislation a bill that said D.C. can't do that, because D.C. is not a state. It's the federal city. It was originally the city of the goddess, right? There's an amazing story behind it that, Jefferson wasn't so involved in this. Ben Franklin and, some of the guys around him, and George Washington and some of his buddies, they were Masons. These guys were mystics. And they thought, okay, we're doing something historic. I mean, there was the Greek democracy, there was the Roman Republic, and now we're creating the American Democratic Republic, a representative democratic republic. And so we have to have something like the Greeks and Romans did. We have to have a goddess. And we've got plenty of gods, right? All the major religions that are represented here in what will become the United States, they all have gods. They're all men. They all have penises. We've got to have a goddess. And so they invented one. They literally created her out of whole cloth. And she's on the top of the Capitol building, and there is a law in the city that says you cannot build any building taller than the top of the goddess's head. Daryl Issa is trying to blow it up, but it's the law. And that's why there's no skyscrapers in D.C. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. Yeah, there's a picture of her right there. Jim is showing her on the top of the Capitol building. That's the tallest point in Washington, D.C. If you could climb up on her head, every building in the city is below that in the district. And the other thing that they said, actually there's a number of things. They put her on our coins. She was on our coins from the George Washington administration until Ronald Reagan took her off the coins. She's in the entryway or lobby or on the literature for pretty much every government agency, the Department of Defense. She's out in front of the Pentagon. I don't know. I've never been to the Pentagon, but I've heard that she's there. She's in one of the entryways holding a shield and a handful of arrows. In the Department of Labor, she's holding a bundle of wheat and a scythe. For the Department of Justice, John Ashcroft, famously, she's there with one breast showing, blindfolded and holding the scales of justice. And John Ashcroft was offended by that naked breast, and so he put a blanket over it for the 3 years of most of the Bush administration. So she represents us all over the place. The French were so in love with her and the idea of her that they gave us a statue of her who is in the harbor in New York City. And when they invented this goddess, they said, she's got to have a name. So what name do we come up with? How do you name a goddess? And they said, well, let's take Christopher Columbus's name. He's kind of thought of as the founder of Europeans in North America. Let's take Christopher Columbus's name and feminize it. And so they simply invented this goddess called Columbia. And then they said, and let's make a city that is dedicated to the goddess. It is the district of the goddess. And anybody who lives and works in this district
must be doing the goddess's work. This is such a noble work, government. This is such noble work that the people living in the district of the goddess cannot have any self-dealing. They cannot do things in Congress that would enrich themselves. They will have no representation in Congress. When they go to the district to do the work of the goddess, they give up their right to have self-interest. They must give of themselves to the public. And that's why our license plates say taxation without representation. We have Eleanor Holmes Norton, who, just in the past couple of decades, was given the right, our representative from the District of Columbia, given the right to speak on the floor of the House of Representatives, but she has no right to vote. And we have no senators. And although we have a population greater than Vermont and Oklahoma, there's over 600,000 people in this city. And as long as the city was majority black, there was no way that the Republicans would entertain any notion about, hey, let's give statehood to D.C. And they're still fighting it because it's mostly a Democratic city. However, it's gentrifying at an amazing rate. And I predict that, you know, when the Republicans, when they've got, when this becomes a majority white city and a majority upper middle class city, which is the gentrification that's happening because of all the lobbyist money that's flooded into D.C. It's 35,000 registered lobbyists in this town. There was only 800 when Reagan came into office. And thus all this money. That eventually, the Republicans will come around and say, oh, gee, yeah, a lot of white people. Let's talk about statehood. But anyhow, Andy Harris, it's Thursday, it's tomorrow, from 11 to noon, a bunch of people here being led by one of the D.C. council members. It's called D.C. Councilmember Andy Harris Constituent Service Day. They're saying, okay, Andy Harris, even though you're the congressman from Maryland, if you think that you represent the district because you're trying to change the rules that we made here for ourselves, you can take care of our other problems. So you got a dead rat in your backyard? Bring it to Andy Harris. You got a pothole in the street out in front of your yard? Take a picture of it. Bring it to Andy Harris. You got a problem with the police department? You know, write it up and bring it to Andy Harris. And so people with complaints that would normally go to the city council or the mayor's office, they're all showing up at Andy Harris's office tomorrow here in Washington, D.C. This is going to be hysterical. Anyhow, back with Anything Goes Summer. Your calls after
You're
this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We've covered a lot of territory here, from the Affordable Care Act to psychotherapy to D.C. statehood and pot. A lot to talk about. We'll be back with your conversation. Okay, the Bring Your Rats to Andy Harris's office. Unfair parking tickets, building permits, potholes, whatever you're complaining about, bring it to Andy Harris's office. They say, be creative. They're meeting tomorrow at 11 a.m. They say, feel free to bring props, but keep in mind that firearms, explosives, and dangerous materials are prohibited. I would guess dead rats are prohibited, too. You could maybe bring a rubber rat. In any case, we will meet outside of Harris's office at 1533 House Longworth Building at 11 a.m. on July 24th. The closest metros are South Capitol on the blue and orange lines or Union Station on the red line. And there is an RSVP. It's RSVP at dcvote.org. This is put on by the group DC. You can visit their website, www.dcvote.org. You know, now that nobody even knows that this is the city of the goddess, nobody seems to respect the goddess. Reagan took her off our coins. I remember when we were living in Vermont, Louise and I did not have a television. We didn't have a TV for the 18 or so years that our kids were growing up, maybe a little longer than that. But I got a newspaper every day. And I remember getting up one morning and going out to the front of the house and to get the newspaper. And there was this giant headline that said, Columbia dies over Texas. And I immediately thought, and George Bush was president. This was in, I forget the year. I want to say it was in 2001 or 2000. Yeah, 2001, but I'm not sure what year it was that space shuttle went down. But I didn't, you know, my first thought was, oh, my God, he killed the goddess. In Texas, of course. Turns out it was the space shuttle, Columbia, that named after the goddess that went down in Texas. But anyway, most Americans would not get that, you know, unless they knew the backstory. Most Americans don't know the backstory. There's a couple of cool books you can get on this stuff. They sell a couple of them at the Spy Store here in D.C., all these, you know, kind of arcane histories of Washington, D.C., mystical histories. Anyhow, let's pick up your calls here. Mike in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Well, couple of things. The Affordable Care Act and the reason that I'm in favor of it. About 3 years ago, I had to go to the emergency room because I kind of overdosed myself on my prescription meds. And that $2,200 bill, I ended up paying $2,000 of it. And one of the things that just frosted my flakes when I got the breakdown on it was the fact that I had to pay $167.97 for a liter of saline,
which is salt water.
Yeah. Because there's people that are too good to, you know, to have their own insurance. So guess what? I got to pay for it. Plus, I think I got screwed by my insurance company. And before that, I had a well-known HBO, I mean HMO, and they discovered that several years ago, about 15 years ago, my PSA was slightly elevated. Well, those dummies at their urologist, all they did was, you know, come back in a few months and we'll do another biopsy on you, and every time they do a biopsy, my PSA would be going up. Yeah. Well, come to find out, I found a urologist that knew what he was doing. And what happens is when you have biopsies, you take that hollow needle, you shove it, you know, into the prostate through the rectum. Right. It takes bacteria with it, and that aggravates your
prostatitis.
Your prostate, which makes your PSA goes up.
Yep.
And those guys never figured it out. They all just wanted me to come back for another biopsy. And then last December, I tried to get on with them again. They were not my last insurance company at that time, and they wouldn't take me because of you have your PSA is real high. And I tried to explain to them it was your people that did this to me, and that they wouldn't listen to me. And now they want my business. And wow. I told them to take it and shove it where the sun don't shine.
Yeah.
But those are the reasons,
Mike, let me just interject, because I've been through this, been there, done that, and had surgery 2 years ago. If your PSA is above 5 or 6, you really do need to find somebody who knows what they're doing.
Right. Right. And it went up. It was up as high as 25.
Wow. That's,
and
this guy
put me on medication, and the last time we checked, it was down to 8.
Oh, okay. So it reacts to antibiotics, and that probably is prostatitis. But I, you know, and I'm not a qualified urologist. But like I said, if with a PSA that high, you should be talking to somebody who knows what they're doing, because you know, the second leading cause of death for men in the United States is prostate cancer. If it gets outside the prostate, and there's even I found one study that indicated that sometimes the cancer gets outside the prostate just by virtue of the biopsy. It follows the needle track. And it can be really, really nasty, and it's a horrible way to die. But anyhow, Mike, yeah, I'm with you. $167 for a bottle of saline, that's obscene. Thanks a lot for the call. And, yeah, and ACA is starting to bend that cost curve. David in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, David, you wanted to correct something that I said about hormone replacement therapy. What's that?
Yeah, first of all, the Republicans are giving me PTSD. But The problem with hormone replacement therapy is that the drug companies are pushing Premarin, which is made from horse urine. So this is estrogen that's meant for a horse, not a human female. they should be using bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, which is geared towards each woman individually based on her blood work, and it does not cause disease. It's the natural way to do it.
Yeah, and I recall, that's what Suzanne Summers was pitching. I mentioned her, and I probably shouldn't have done so in a disparaging way.
I have the name of the organization, nonprofit, where anybody in America can find a doctor in their area, men too, who want natural hormone replacement. It's ACAM.org. And I also have the natural therapy for sleep disorder, and that's melatonin.
Right.
Melatonin is the sleep hormone that we have in abundance when we're children.
Right.
That's why children can sleep through an earthquake.
I take melatonin every night, David. Just be sure to take the time-release version.
Yeah, and also based on how much you weigh. I weigh about 170. I take 3 to 6 milligrams a night, and it's terrific. It's natural.
Yep.
There's no bad...
I started using melatonin 30 years ago when I was flying a lot internationally. I was doing international relief work, and it solves jet lag like nobody's business. I mean, it's amazing. Before I discovered melatonin, I'd been using all these god-awful sleeping pills and things. And I was just, you know, jet lag was killing me, probably literally. And melatonin is just, it's amazing. And you can use it on a regular basis. It's, what's interesting is that you can't buy it in the UK. I have friends in the UK who come over here to buy melatonin because it's considered a prescription drug there. And you know, Lunesta, the drug Lunesta that they market on television as a sleep medication, as the safe sleep medication, it's a synthetic form of melatonin. So it's
not as good as the natural.
No, it's not as good as the natural. It's got all these side effects associated with it, but it binds to the melatonin receptors in the brain. It makes the brain think it's getting melatonin, and so it produces an effect similar to melatonin. And you can buy melatonin in the drugstore for $4 a bottle. You know, it's like, it's no big deal. So anyhow, David, thank you for sharing those things. I appreciate it. Martin in Sarasota, Florida, listening on WMNF. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Hello, how you doing? Love your show. I'm trying to get some bumper stickers, put them on the back of the car. But
cool.
I consider myself a progressive warrior down here in Sarasota. I got a lot of conservative people, really elderly demographics here. I see how it is. But I just wanted to ask you about, I hear you rant a couple of times, totally genius, but about the post office and the media are two businesses that should be funded through the government, and you state that it's in the Constitution.
No, I've never said the media should be funded by the government. The media is protected by the First Amendment, the right to a free press, but it doesn't say that the free press has a subsidy. Although we did subsidize the press in the early days of the Republic, and we still do, the Post Office subsidizes newspapers by allowing newspapers to be shipped through the U.S. mail at a fraction of what it would cost if it was even third-class mail. And we also, you know, the Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution has a sentence in it that says that Congress is authorized to appropriate money to build roads for postal roads for the post office to use to deliver mail to people.
Right. And other than that, given the state of the media, and now with the FCC ruling, you just don't know what's going to happen. That's the ultimate end game of which I think they're trying to get to with everything else, is just eventually be able to cut off the media, which you believe should be the fourth branch of government.
Yes.
To regulate the other three branches.
Yep, it's the fourth estate. And this is the net neutrality battle.
How about an app, something that out there that you are aware of that people are getting involved in, kind of maybe even to structure their local politics, and then maybe nationally have the overall opinion of the American progressive people out there?
Sure. Martin, there's a bunch of great groups that are doing that kind of work. Check out pdamerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America, movetoamend.org, moveon.org. There's a bunch of democracyforamerica.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Environmental groups, celldef.org. Find a group that shares your passion and participate, because movement politics has always driven politics in this country. Welcome back. Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I heard you talking about the bilateral therapy, and I
you know, specifically you were mentioning walking being part of that. Yeah. Is running or jogging part of that too, or is that something different? Because I do know about the euphoria that supposedly joggers and runners get.
Yeah, I think the runner's high is associated with, you know, a release of endorphins as a consequence of the exhaustion of muscle groups, or maybe the exhaustion of all the easily available glycogen in the liver or muscles or something. But when I was writing the book, I was in part making a living as a consultant to psychiatrists and psychologists about NLP. And there were a number of them, and I write about this in the book. I include some of the cases. There were a number of these folks who I said, you know, I'll give you this session free, or I'll give you, you know, a couple of sessions for free if you will try this with your patients. You know, have them try, you know, this, you know, just taking their problems and walk with them, because these people were all in the business of, you know, healing people who were having mental, psychiatric, emotional issues, whatever it may be. And a couple of them took me up on it and did it. And one of them had a patient who was who ran on a treadmill at home every day for a half hour. And she had her try that with her particular trauma, which, as I recall, was, I don't want to get into the details because I'm not sure I've revealed those details in the book. But in any case, and the therapist herself tried it as well. And both of them reported back that working on a treadmill worked just as well as walking. It's just a matter of the time. So I don't have personal experience with that. I'm not a runner. And every time I try to run more than, you know, 60 or 70 feet, I end up injuring my ankle. but I can, you know, I've had personal experience of it working from walking. And I know a lot of, you know, the vast majority of people that I know who have tried this have done it walking. And you can find, you know, some of the comments over on Amazon and whatnot and other places, people talking about the book saying, oh, yeah, I tried this. It really works. And a couple of people have tried running and have said that it works. So,
oh,
yeah.
Cool.
The key would not be distracted. So not to be carrying anything in your hands, to be able to, you know, focus and to be running a course that you know well enough that you're not constantly thinking about, do I need to turn left or right here? You know, running can be a little more distracting than walking because you've got sensory data coming by so fast relative to walking. You've got to make decisions faster. You know, shall I cross this street now or not? That kind of thing. And so the key would be to do it in a way that, and maybe on a treadmill it's easier, to do it in a way that you can run while not being just, you know, continually distracted. It's okay to be periodically distracted. Our minds wander. That's just, you know, the nature of us, whether you're walking or running. But the more you can, a person can do this exercise of, you know, bringing that picture or that feeling up and just nibbling away at it piece by piece until it's finally gone, while they are engaged in a bilateral activity. I'm convinced even the dancing like Native Americans and indigenous people all around the world do, where you're just standing in one spot, moving, going from left to right to left to the right to left to right to left to right. I think it all works the same way. And similarly, you can get a metronome close enough to you that it's crossing the midline, so your eyes are crossing your nose as they go from left to right. You could even arguably do it with a metronome, which would be, you know, a variation on James Braid's pocket watch from 1834, his hypnosis. Mike, thanks for the call, and good luck. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and June in Shawano, Wisconsin. Hey, June, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to know if you were familiar with Psych K.
Psych K? No, I'm not.
K.
Yeah.
K as in
Kellogg's?
K as in Kinesis.
I'm familiar with kinesiology but Psych K, I don't know.
Well, it's a program where you use the kinetic energy of the body to actually locate your subconscious, and you can move back and forth between your subconscious and your conscious.
Yes, these are strategies that are part of NLP.
Right. And my doctor, who had a problem in her life, contacted a therapist, and he taught this to her, and she brought it to her class. And it helped many people. to look at things, particularly child abuse, you know, that had occurred when they were young, and domestic violence and things like that. And it was quite successful. You don't walk in as in walking the blues away, excuse me, but you are can stand in the spot, and this helps people.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for that, June. I'll have to do a little digging with my DuckDuckGo machine. Thank you for sharing that. Jerry in Long Island, listening to WBAI. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. Yeah, I'd like to discuss the Malaysian Flight 17.
Sure.
Yeah, Flight 17 plane crash. That was stupid the way I said it. It made it sound like...
I think you said it right. It's Malaysian Flight 17.
Yeah.
What about it?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to challenge at least two bits of conventional wisdom about it. I mean, first of all, in addition to wanting to challenge this idea of blaming Putin for everything that goes wrong in the Ukraine, first of all, I'd like to challenge the idea that the so-called pro-Russian Ukrainian separatists shot down this Malaysian plane. And, you know, in reporting this whole tragic situation, I see the American corporate so-called mainstream media, I see them making at least one of the same mistakes they made in the lead-up to the war in Iraq, in the sense that the American media is being too quick to buy into whatever the official U.S. government source told them, with them suspending both critical thinking, and they're also suspending...
Well, here's the thing, though, Jerry. With the war in Iraq, we all know, you know, Bush wanted to... There were factions within the administration who for their own reasons, wanted the war in Iraq. Bush wanted it because he wanted to be a war president. Cheney wanted it because he wanted the oil. Wolfowitz wanted it because he thought that if we put a giant footprint in the Middle East, that we would be able to then control the Middle East and eventually solve the Palestinian-Israeli problem and everything else. All these people had an agenda. What possible agenda would the United States have from, ginning up bad intelligence about who shot down Flight 17?
Well, I think
who wins? Who benefits?
I think there are people in the Obama administration who are very conservative and very hawkish, and they would love to stir up a new Cold War, which helps the American defense industry, the military-industrial complex, because the more there's tensions between Russia and the United States, the more that helps defense contractors like Lockheed Martin sell, for example, anti-Russian aircraft that have only one purpose, and that's to fight Russian aircraft. These anti-Russian fighter jets that they are poised to sell hundreds of
the
Pentagon. In any event, there would be no purpose to sale of this sort to the Pentagon otherwise in the absence of tensions between the United States and Russia.
Yeah.
So I think they have that agenda. The new Ukrainian government has an agenda of trying to demonize and vilify these people in Donetsk who simply want more independence and autonomy. I think some of them would be willing to accept the kind of compromise that Professor Cohen was describing last week, where they simply had more independence and autonomy.
Right, the right to vote for their own mayors and governors.
Yeah. But you have other separatists who are, you have other people in Donetsk who are obviously violent and...
Doesn't that make a lot of sense, though, Jerry, that what we're talking about here is just drunken rednecks?
What do you mean?
Some of these rebels are, you know, in any rebel force, in any army, in any military force, but particularly an ad hoc military force, you're going to have basically, a certain percentage of drunken rednecks. And you give them a surface-to-air missile, and they have used them successfully before Flight 17 was shot down, and they just used them apparently in the last 24 hours on two Ukrainian jets. So you give them a surface-to-air missile, and, you know, they're not thinking clearly, and they're not. This is why I don't think that these guys were connected to the Russian government, because the Russian government, any government, frankly, because any government could have dialed up air traffic control and known immediately what was in the air and known that was a civilian airliner. But, you know, it seems to me like it's drunken rednecks. You know, the question is where did they get the armaments from and who, and how and why and all that kind of stuff, which brings up the questions of, you know, ISIS in Iraq that we were arming when they were the Syrian opposition in Syria. And, you know, are we going to take responsibility for the fact that in Mosul they're demanding that people put, you know, veils on the faces of women in the mannequins in the store windows? I mean...
But why are we so quick to reject the idea that the Ukrainian government could have accidentally either shot down these planes or crashed? We're so quick. To
apparently the U.S. radar. I mean, this was released by the White House today. We've got the radar track of the missile going up and hitting the plane, and it came out of an area that was controlled by these rebels. Pardon?
Well, that's what's claimed. But that's what's claimed. We have to be a little things we're told. It's like Professor Kong was saying last week, all governments lie, and there was a woman on Face the Nation this past week who was saying that there's propaganda on all sides involved here.
I think that's true. Jerry, I honestly don't know. So therefore, the drunken redneck theory makes a lot of sense to me, but I don't know, and so I'm not saying. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. It's much appreciated. We will be back tomorrow for another day of fascinating factoids and opinions and whatnot. And don't forget, democracy starts with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow. Maybe at Andy Harris's office. Who knows?
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.